This is CIOI 101.5 FM. The Hawk is on the air.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Katrina Bell of the Copper Bell and Artisanally. This interview was originally recorded on August 11th, 2020. To start with, can you introduce yourself for listeners?
Yes, my name is Katrina Bell. I run a little candle company out of Guelph called the Copper Bell, which I shamelessly named after myself because I'm very uncreative. And then started a little bit of a passion project, other business kind of thing called Artisanally. Originally, it was called The Local Box. So that kind of came out of COVID and the weirdness of the world right now. But it's been a wild ride.
Yeah, I would love to ask you about both. I guess maybe if the Copper Bell preceded current situation, maybe we could start there and you could tell me a bit more about the business, I guess, where you're at and what you do and maybe some of the motivation behind it when you started it.
Sure. So it kind of just started for like a fun creative outlet. I think like a lot of people, I love candles and I love burning candles, and I would buy a lot of I tend to just say big store candles rather than dropping specific store names, but people know what I mean.
Yeah.
The big candle store. I burned a lot of those, and then I got pregnant and had a baby, and I found after that I was super sensitive to smells and couldn't burn anything anymore, so I kind of just gave away all my stuff and slowly started getting back into candles by burning unscented candles. And it gets really boring really quickly. So I started making candles and I was reading a little bit about what goes into a candle, why are some people sensitive to smells and not others and that kind of thing. And went, oh, okay, maybe it's the kind of wax that I'm using. So I will start using soy wax, and then just it grew from there. My best friend is obsessed with candles. So it's been fun to try out new scents and just send them off to her. And, I have a little friend group that I call my focus group, and we all test the scents, and it's fun. It started from just wanting to make things for myself and then my friends. And then, it was kind of Christmas market season. So I thought, you know what, why don't I try to sell these and get into something like that? I had also just changed jobs around the end of last year, kind of the same time that I started the Copper Bell. I left a job and a career path that I was in for about 6 years.
Wow.
And so I just wanted something different and something creative and fun. And so I started doing that. And it's just been kind of my little fun side passion project that is thankfully growing. And it's just fun. It's kind of cool to, throw some music on and make some candles and come up with funny names. And then get to talk to people about this cute thing that you make.
Yeah, I think the personal connection of getting to talk to people that you're selling to is a really special part of that sort of independent business. I don't know, maybe there's a part where you get too successful and stop having as many opportunities to be so personable and one-on-one, but definitely I found there's a beautiful period of time where everybody is a little bit more of a connection than just a purchase,
Yeah. And that's the difficult thing about COVID too, is that you kind of lose that. So I've done one in-person market, not some online thing where you're just running a sale and hoping that people want to buy your candles because of the funny names. It's such a thing that you need to buy in person. I think a candle, there's only so many ways to describe a scent. I did the first market in Uptown Waterloo with the Uptown Waterloo Business Association sure I'm getting something wrong about that name, but it was amazing. Like, you get to just sort of chat with people again and like have that personable connection that I've been really missing. So
I find it really fascinating that you describe having to buy a candle as something you have to do in person, because I had never really considered that. Like, it seemed like exactly the sort of item that you could buy based on it will burn and it smells like. And so it's really interesting. I don't think I realized the sort of personal moment of, and it makes sense now that you mention it. I mean, I do that with soap. I love picking up a bar.
Certainly can, and definitely people have bought stuff without smelling it, but there's something nice where, you know, if I say, oh, this smells like sweet pea, you know, the flowers, and then you come in person, you smell it, and you go, this reminds me of like a perfume that my grandmother used to buy. It's a totally different experience than just going, oh, you know, I like floral scents when you read a description, or like, oh, this has got a scent memory for me. So
I've heard, I have two children. I guess I developed sensitivities too when I was pregnant, not ones around scent, but I guess more diet.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of friends who have scent issues, including my own grandmother. And so growing up, yeah, it wasn't something that was around a lot, like a fake smell. And I naively had assumed in the last 20 to 30 years since that period of time that the big, you know, air quotes, candle businesses would have gotten a lot better. Like, why lean into synthetic smells? What are some of the things that they include that, and do you have theories as to why they're still making candles that way when they're literally poisonous for some people?
It's cheaper. It's a cost thing. Like, soy candles are more expensive because they're more expensive to make. And I think it's cheaper, or it's just something that, like, there hasn't been a ton of research into, God, I can spell the word, but if I try and say it, phthalates, it's P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E.
Okay.
Phthalate.
Yeah. I think
But there's stuff. So there's, most candle makers will use fragrance oils, and that's like they're regulated. They're like, it's some scientific magic that just makes things smell like other things. And it's great. And I use fragrance oils. And some have ingredients that are harmful and some don't. And so you've got to kind of be careful to find your suppliers that don't have some of those other things. You know, I really focused on like kind of leaving those things out, and then the wax as well. So not using a paraffin wax. And paraffin is, it's a, like an oil, it's derived from oil. So it's a, like the same kind of thing that you would be putting in your car. It gets refined into candle wax also.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so that kind of has a weird other part of everything too, with it. It's generally, I think that a lot of people still use it, and the big companies still use it, but it, you get stronger scents with paraffin wax than with soy wax, typically. So it's cheaper, and you get like a candle that's going to more easily like fill a room. And so I think it's sort of for that reason, like people know, you know, those big three wick candle things, like they know that their whole house is going to smell like whatever, cinnamon buns or whatever scent you pick up. So I, you know, that's how they built their brand, right? Is these.
Yeah. So as a person who used to have a lot of those candles, did you enjoy that all encompassing, like massive relationship with scent?
No, I think like I would never burn them for a long time. It was just sort of like, that's all I knew that candles did. Mm-hmm. And you can definitely get like a good, strong, not as strong, but you can still get a good candle that like is going to fill your house and cover whatever scents you're looking to cover in whatever room you're looking to cover them in. But it's just different than with the soy wax.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are some of the challenges with the way you do things? Like, of course, there's the cost. You mentioned that it is maybe more expensive to use soy wax, but are there other things that you have to consider? Like, is there any sort of expiry, or do things burn differently in a way that needs to be considered?
Like in comparison to making it kind of.
Yeah, like say you had access to those other ingredients and scent wasn't an issue. I wonder if like there's other things that you have to do sort of differently, or like, is it more challenging to do it the way you do it?
I don't have a big production line. I make them in my kitchen, right? So that's the challenge for me. I don't know though. I don't think so. I've only ever worked with soy. I haven't really kind of delved into anything else. So I don't know. I don't think so. You know, you're just sort of kind of, it's all just measuring things. It's, you know, what's your wax to scent ratio and that kind of a thing. So weird little things that you learn that you would never think of. Like, there's only so much oil you can put in wax before it just sort of, if you ever get a candle and it's kind of like sweaty on top, there's like something sitting on top of it that's like, mm-hmm. the wax was just too saturated and it couldn't hold enough oil.
Okay. Yeah. That's sort of what I was thinking. Like, I don't know really anything about candle making, but certainly, I mean, it happens with soaps and stuff as well, where certain ones, if they're left out in the heat, they just like almost like sweat or something differently than ones maybe you buy in a store. And, I don't know. It's one of those things where it surprises me that places don't, like, you could make just as much of a profit on making natural candles if you were charging appropriately for it. Like, I sometimes wonder if it's the consumers that are perpetuating the patterns of using bad products, too.
We are a culture that wants cheap and fast and, like, same-day delivery kind of thing, you know? Yeah. So I'm sure that, like, if someone sees the price of a candle and they're going, oh, well, this is smaller and it's twice the price, like, why would I buy that when I can just go to whatever store and they're always having sales and I'll get one of those huge candles for like $10? Why am I going to pay you $20 for your smaller candle? So,
Yeah. It's interesting that
our consumer culture.
Yeah. It's hard. I sort of like around people starting to understand how problematic Amazon is.
Yes, it's like I can't get away from it. I can't escape it. I know that it's a problem and I'm still like, oh, but I really need that duct cover.
Yeah, well, in terms of trying to break some of the patterns that we have as consumers, so I think like the dollar store is probably a good example of a place where things that feel like sort of incidental or like they're like little bonus pieces of your day-to-day life. Like, I think maybe people don't as often impulsively buy food at the dollar store, for example. Some people would for sure, certain things, but
like a candy or something like
right.
that.
Right. But like, if it comes down to like making a whole meal out of ingredients there's probably a hesitation. And then, I mean, I think like, my relationship with candles, it isn't a big one, but like it, because that is going in my body through smell, it's one that I've never been inclined to go to the dollar store for example, because if it's going to be in me or on me, I have to kind
be
of
a little bit
think
more
about
careful.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in terms of people trying to, I guess, get more mindful about where they get the things that they end up consuming, what do you think like are things standing in the way of making that easier? So using Amazon as an example of one that a lot of people who are entrepreneurial people and starting their own businesses, the businesses themselves are like local and often like ethical, very thoughtful, lots of steps. But then there's one piece, say the label on the bottle or the wick, there may be like one or two items. I know for myself, finding ink for my sublimation printer is one that is challenging to navigate without these big corporations. So what are some of the things that make it challenging to run a business that really is hitting all of the marks without like, you know, what are some of the barriers?
Oh God. I mean, I think you've highlighted them, just finding them. I use suppliers. So I guess I also haven't, you know, I look for ingredients and I look for that kind of thing. And I know like, okay, this company grows the soybeans that turns into my wax. And I know that, but when it comes down to like the stickers that I use or, you know, who I get my labels printed, because I outsource that. So who prints my labels? My uncle has a printing company out in Orangeville. So just there you go. I'm supporting my like another family business, but like, oh yeah, where do they get all of their stuff? I've never thought about that. Like things like that. So, I don't know.
It's hard to wrap my head around when I try to think of like how many times when you don't have to think about it too, when you've outsourced to somewhere good, but then they have to make moral decisions on their end about their pieces.
Yeah, I think you could go down an endless rabbit hole of figuring out, like, going, okay, this is my supplier. Who's my supplier's supplier? Where, you know, I don't know where things start. I just know where I get them from. So probably that is just the lack of access to information about things like that, you know? Mm-hmm. Or like, you see, I guess this is totally unrelated, but just access to information makes me think of like drop shipping companies. So you think you're buying something from a company and they're just like the middleman. They bought it directly from China and they're sending it to you, you know, mm-hmm. like that kind of a thing. So yeah. Oh my goodness. This is going to be such an existential conversation.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you mentioned that that's a different topic, but it kind of isn't. I think that's a big one. That's happened a number of times where I'm searching for something online and I put Canada or Ontario, or I try to put in keywords and, you know, I get a .ca come up. I'm like, great, I must be in Canada. But you're absolutely right. A lot of the time it's just redirected products from somewhere else that may or may not be coming out of a factory in Scarborough when they send it to me, but it came from somewhere else before that. And yeah, that's challenging.
Yeah. And so, I very much consider my products Canadian made, but are all the ingredients that go into my products Canadian? I mean, I know for sure my wax is American. It's American soy wax. So like things like that, you're like, oh, I don't know. Yeah. I've never thought about that. My jars come out of the States there, but you know, it's an American company. Do they outsource the creation of the, like, are they manufactured? Oh my goodness. I was not prepared for this kind of
I know, I feel almost like it's turned into like a marketplace expose as opposed to a conversation. But yeah, I mean, I do my best to just be, you know, intentional and thoughtful about the decisions I make. And I mean, I feel like any efforts that we're making to think about why or where we're getting things from have to be steps in the right direction, even if they're not the full picture of every single part of it being totally ideal.
Yeah, it's so tough. It's I think awesome to want to support local businesses and to try to know where things come from, and it can be so difficult when you really get into the nitty-gritty of each individual piece of the whole that you're consuming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the candle business is very much a self-created venture.
Mm-hmm.
But you did mention that you've recently transitioned into another project that has come out of this pandemic. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So I am still working on both, and sometimes one gets more attention than the other. It's a hard balancing act. But it kind of started as it was just a single curated box. So here's a bunch of cool things made by people in like the Guelph, Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge area. You know, you either like it or you don't, you'll buy it or you won't. And then I kind of grew it into, well, here's, maybe you want an option to pick and choose what you want in your box. Or maybe you want an option to you know, pick a price point and I'll make you a surprise or things like that. So I've sort of grown it to have all these different iterations, but I don't even really know how to describe it. It's kind of a box, not a subscription box, online marketplace type of thing, where I every month bring in a new group of vendors. So artists, artisans, handcrafted things like jewelry, candles, not always my candles, other people's candles too. Candles, soaps, macrame. I have ceramic mugs in right now. Yeah, like just a bunch of cool stuff like you would find if you went to a market. So it all sort of started because markets were just, you know, it was like the middle of March and it was like, okay, there's nothing. Like everything is closed. Stores that you might sell your stuff in as like a little handmade business, they're closed. Like you just have no idea what's going on. So kind of being a candle maker and being at least having a toe in the pool of this world of creative people, I know a lot of people who kind of make their way in the world with their handcrafted things. And sort of the first few versions of things were my friends and were people that I knew and I could reach out to and say, like, do you want to just try something with me and see if it works and see if we can get a few extra sales because we have nowhere else to sell our stuff. yeah. And so it's just sort of grown from there. And it's been a really fun way to kind of meet other small businesses in the area beyond what I already, all the people I've already known, things like that.
Did some of those same stores that would have otherwise held your products or some of the markets themselves, did any of those folks come on board to help steer this? Or is it mainly the artists that make the stuff that are behind
it? It's just been the artists. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's, I guess I hadn't really even thought to reach out to the stores that I was in that closed or, you know, I was in a market that canceled and you get your refunds and stuff. And I hadn't really thought about that avenue. It's been just sort of the artists and the makers and a little collective thing. And it's been fun too. So, you know, I had an old name and then I did a rebranding with a friend of a friend, like a really great graphic designer out of Kitchener, also a photographer. They wear many hats. That got me thinking of, like, I feel like the whole world of art and creativity, it's all about like networking, but not in like a gross, like you're just trying to get a leg up. But like, I have met so many people because I knew somebody who could like, who does something that I might need help with or like makes a cool product that I should check out or something like that, you know? So it's such a communal world and like very interconnected once you start getting in and like meeting all these like artists and things like that. It's fun. It's just, I don't know, it's been a really great experience.
Yeah, I feel like I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. It feels like a throwback to the like artisans, like back in a period of time where even people's last names were their livelihood. And, you know, you'd know the metal worker and the candle maker, the butcher, and surely they'd be trading services rather than money wherever possible. And I mean, that to me, I remember being in elementary school and learning about artisans and them telling us about the different kinds and people who made furniture. And I remember just visualizing a little house and picturing all the pieces of what's in a house and that there was a person behind every one of those. And that seemed so novel when I was a kid, because even by that point, we had drifted so far away from anything in your house being made by a real person.
Yeah, you don't go to the butcher, you just go to Zehrs, and like, that's where you get your food from. Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, and so I love bartering. Like, you meet people and you're like, oh, I really like what you make. Like, if you like what I make, let's just do a trade. It's great. It's a very different kind of community than anything outside of that we kind of live in right now.
Has it been influenced by the pandemic in your experience? I know that that's when you really started leaning into this particular type of market. So maybe you didn't have another version of yours to compare it to, but have you found that during the pandemic, people's priorities have shifted in a way that you're seeing reflected in their enthusiasm around this type of project?
I think at the beginning there was a big, push to support local and to care about all the small businesses that were shut down or maybe shifting to like trying to do things online or just any of that kind of stuff. There was definitely like that initial kind of surge of supporting local. I think kind of as things have gone on and people are struggling more with like disposable income and, you know, maybe they were laid off and they're back to work so they don't have the time or any of that kind of stuff, where you just sort of get I'm trying to think of the right word, but like fatigued almost, I guess is what I'm trying to say, where you, it's hard to keep caring about issues for so long, so people kind of stop. You know, we see it all the time with like social justice issues or anything like that, and so not to make this at the same level of anything like that, but it's just that idea of like, you know, oh yeah, I know I need to kind of support my local small businesses, but like, it's the summer and I don't know, people go away to their cottage or whatever. You kind of forget after a while. So,
yeah, I think it's totally fair to relate it to the social justice movements, because it isn't that it's the same, but it is the same kinds of like there's sort of a rush of enthusiasm or focus that things get. And I actually think it's also, when that happens, sometimes it's a bit easier to figure out what you can do. Mm-hmm. Like when it's a popular topic, there's more people linking to articles about five ways you can support this thing or five ways you can do yes. this thing.
And when we love enthusiasm, a listicle.
We do. Like, you know, if you're overwhelmed by the idea of trying to be more mindful or, you know, shop local is such a fantastic, whoever marketed that as a phrase, mm-hmm. it's just so literal. It's so mm-hmm. like there, that's where you go. And when we could go somewhere in person, I feel like that was a really easy one for people to wrap their head around. Like if they walk down to their downtown and go into a store that is not a big box store, that is what local is.
Yes.
And I could see how that very same kind of catchphrase is harder to articulate when there's no walking downtown to anywhere for a period mm-hmm. of time. Like, how do you get the same kind of catchment, like easy descriptor to tell people exactly where to go who want to help but are overwhelmed by having to figure out how?
Yeah.
I don't know. But I don't really know what the solution is. I guess like markets like the one you're building, you know, that maybe is sort of almost like a checklist of options for people.
Yeah. And it's an easy way to highlight and say this, you know, this jewelry maker is from Cambridge. Like my focus has been since I started like these kind of four, you know, Kitchener, Waterloo, three, four towns. In this area that are all sort of lumped together. Like I think of it as one little local area. Mm-hmm. And so to just try to highlight that everybody, all the artists and the artisans are from, they're your neighbors and they're your friends. And like, you can kind of just shop them all in one place easily. Cause maybe that store that we're all in, it's probably open now, but it wasn't open, you know, when I started this. And so things like that made it a little easier.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Katrina Bell of The Copper Bell in Artisanally. Do you think even as we start to return to spaces being open that some of these other sorts of infrastructures or these new ventures like yours that have emerged, do you think that they have a place alongside the other? Do you know, like, because I
totally know what you mean. I hope so is my answer to that. I think people like online shopping, so I hope so. You know, but yeah, I think so, and I hope so. That's my answer.
Well, I mean, it is technically online shopping, but I think there's a context, like a curation and kind of, I don't know, like more of the story, more of the origin available in the way you're presenting it than it just being things. Like, it actually strikes me as a person who loves going to those marketplaces. I rarely spend any time figuring out where anyone's from until I'm actually like looking at their object and curious about it. Yeah. So it strikes me that knowing almost the story first is a really interesting opportunity that you have. Like if you're reading about it almost before you're ever seeing it in person, mm-hmm. you kind of, because I could see items being so much more exciting when you have the context. Say like a bar of soap, knowing where that came from and who made it could be the difference of that one over another one. So I think there's like a real potential opportunity for you to have story first, context first, item supported by that instead of us just always being drawn to the thing. You know?
Yes. Aren't these earrings pretty? It's here's Lisa who made something and like this is Lisa's story and this is why she makes something. Mm-hmm. Isn't that kind of a much cooler way of getting to know someone? Yeah. I try on my Instagram. I try to focus. I do like a little meet the maker kind of post or things like that. To just sort of try to talk about the people behind the products. Cause there's a million candle makers and there's a million soap makers and, you know, what differentiates one over the other. But they're all made by someone, some individual whose hopes and dreams are in this bar of soap.
Well, what are some of the positive things these two ventures have done for you during a time where You know, we're living through a pandemic together, and there's going to be a lot of struggle. I mean, I don't mind you also talking about some of the struggles, but like, maybe what are some of the pluses that have come out of these ventures?
It's kind of made me realize that I don't want to go back to like any kind of a corporate world. So there's at least that, where I think so many of us are creative and we get kind of shoehorned into you're just working a job to work a job. So just to be able to really embrace like my creative side and my, like, I love talking to people and I love working events and I love doing that kind of thing. So to kind of get to meet a whole bunch of new people and feel like I'm supporting other people, and then like getting to give gifts to people is my job right now. These are essentially gift boxes. Like, when I was laid off at the beginning of COVID, one of the first things I did, I had been building just little gift boxes to bring to my best friends, just because I wanted to like do something positive. I got fired and was like, well, I don't have anything to do tomorrow, so I guess I'll go deliver my friends some gifts. Like, and now I get to just deliver gifts every week and hear really intimate stories from people about like, they want to send a gift to their friend who's, you know, has these health issues, or congratulate somebody on a new baby and they can't be with them. Like, things like that are just, that's my favorite thing. That's the positive, is like getting to be so involved in other people's lives and still feel connected in this very disconnected, weird, like video chat world. But negatives are, you mentioned you have a kid. I have a toddler who is hopefully napping right now, probably not napping. But challenges are just having enough hours in the day to do everything. Like, I feel like you must too. I feel like I'm working like four jobs right now, where you're a full-time parent, like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's been like 5 or 6 months now. And maybe a teacher if your children are older, and you're also trying to work your job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, be a partner in some way if you're in a relationship and have your kids, and also like maybe find time for yourself to be a human being who gets their needs met. So that's my challenge. Yeah, I can answer pluses and minuses.
Oh yeah. Well, when you're describing what you were getting out of it, I remember seeing somewhere some article that was like, stop turning everything into a side hustle. It was about how guilty we are of not just having hobbies, but turning them into businesses. But like, honestly, when you're describing the positives, and they're all work, but they're like the pleasures, but I think sometimes when you have enough other responsibilities, that's the closest you get to time for you. Yeah. Is still working, but on your terms. But on a thing that makes you happy. But it is, it's still work. Like, that's the craziest part to me. It is not leisure in the true sense. It is not like an actual opportunity to check out or get away from anything, really. It's still full engagement and so much consideration for the other people that interface with it. You know,
like, seen and attacked by that article. But, something's got to pay for these things that you like to do. If I want to fill my house with candles, then I need other people to buy these candles so I can afford to keep my
candles. Oh, yeah. No, I know that feeling so well. I really relate to the way you describe that. And yeah, my children are older, so they're out of the napping and toddler stages. And I feel like there's challenges that come with them being older. There's also lots of things that makes more possible. I mean, they were toddlers. I remember that too, right? But yeah, if you're willing, I'd love to carve a bit more into that, because so you were in a different profession and laid off because of the pandemic, or at least that was the timeline.
Yeah. So I had, like I mentioned, just changed jobs end of October. So I used to be in prospect research, and it's a job that no one's ever heard of. But I worked with fundraisers at charities to help find background information on like major donors or corporations or things like that. So you get to know what makes this person tick, what do they like to donate to, how can we appeal to them to get a donation from them, that kind of thing.
Yep.
I wanted to be a fundraiser. I wanted to be that front-facing person who gets to talk to people and like develop those relationships and that kind of thing. And that didn't really pan out. And so I moved into like the business side of things. So I went into a salesy type role at a tech company in Waterloo, so business development. So I spent my whole day calling people and asking them to check out a product. But I got that, like, I get to talk to people. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And so my daughter was sick. She got like a tummy bug the week before everything kind of shut down. So I was off for a few days working from home with her. And then the office shut down, I think it was March 16th. That was sort of when like the world, that was the Monday that the world was like, we're not doing anything anymore. So we just never went back. And March 31st, they laid off about a quarter of their worldwide offices. So I'm not sure that they, like, I think it just sort of shifted priorities for the company of, like many tech companies, they are not, they were not revenue positive. Like, you just sort of, like Amazon, we talk about Amazon. Amazon doesn't make money, but Jeff Bezos is a billionaire. Like, make money, you know what I mean?
I do.
So their priorities shifted, I think, with the pandemic and things changing. So they wanted to move into a revenue positive kind of model. So laid off a ton of people, closed some international offices. So that was end of March. And I think maybe a couple weeks later, I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do now? Like, what's my choice? I can't go job hunting and go to an interview and say like, please hire me. But also I can't actually do any work because I'm home with my kid all day. Mm-hmm. Not actually going to be able to do my job, but like, I would really love it if you could hire me. So I kind of was just like, well, I guess I make candles. I've got that already. Like, let's see if I can grow that and then think of something else that's, I can fit in around meeting her needs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's such a huge topic in and of itself, but one I'd love to follow with you because it, I feel like it's common to have people describe that during this time, it's really given them some time with themselves and to consider like what their priorities look like. And it has really drawn attention to really beautiful things that have come back that a lot of them didn't even realize were gone. Maybe it's time with family or free time, air quotes, or whatever it is. But I do think a lot about what the return to working looks like, because some of us never stopped working. Mm-hmm. But we stopped having jobs. Mm-hmm. But I'm a person whose job continued. It looked very different, but there was no real bump in the road in terms of like being compensated for my time. So I was in a very unique position compared to most people I know because I didn't have to worry about that at any point. So I kind of got to hit the ground running with considering like, what are my options? What can I do right now with this new reality and not be as scared of it? But I do worry a lot about the parents, in particular moms.
It's always moms.
Yeah. Like I hate being gendered about these things, but I think that if, like you were describing the role of being a partner, if you have a person in your life who maybe both of you have whatever opportunities to bring like money to the table, you know, if families are going to have to lean into one of those people working and one supporting the children, it's going to probably come down to whose job pays more. And that has statistically still been men. And so I do worry that while I'm inspired by the new enthusiasm for creating our own enterprises and being entrepreneurial and doing things on our terms, I'm also scared of the new reality, like keeping us down.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like what, I don't know if like you've had thoughts about what support could look like to make both possible. Is there a way to set up an infrastructure that like you can do things on your terms and build your own business and not be like held back by the fact that that has to happen simultaneously with being a mom?
I mean, just the infrastructure, like the emergency response benefit, the CERB has been like a game changer. That's the reason that I could try and do something. And even if I'm not making money doing it, I have money coming in because luckily, I guess I was laid off from a job, you know, so I get to get some of that income coming in. So it'll be interesting to see how things change when that sort of dries up. And I know there's been a lot of talk about like, we should have a UBI. very in favor of a UBI. I think it would change.
Universal basic income. Yes.
It would change. It would, as we're saying, benefit a lot of women. I think a lot of people, but a lot of women, because you are, you kind of default to being the parent. Going to be the main parent. And that's like, I have absolutely nothing against my husband. He's amazing, but he works a job that he cannot work from home. Mm-hmm. So if he goes out and he does like freight delivery kind of things, like huge construction equipment, like you can't not do that. So yeah. He runs that business. It's just sort of like this is going to happen and it can't not happen. So I worked a job where I work on my computer. I can do that from anywhere. So it just sort of made sense that like, well, yeah, obviously I'm going to be the one who's home. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that tends to happen a lot too, is not even just the making more money, but the types of work that men and women traditionally have. Like, mm-hmm. women are probably going to be more likely to work jobs where they can work remotely or work from somewhere else. They're not working like in a trades field or something like that, you know, mm-hmm. or like it's 95% men in the trades or something insane. I'm just throwing numbers out.
Yeah, but no, yeah, yeah.
So that I feel like I keep answering your questions and then getting very far away from what the question was.
I think that's like far
my
more
brain goes somewhere and like, oh, you know what? Universal basic income, that would be great.
Well, I mean, one thing for me, so in my case, the gender roles are quite reversed. I am one of the weird exceptions where I am the primary, like, traditional livelihood of the partner, and my partner is the one who is in a better position to take on the front end of the homeschooling emergency learning situation. But the thing that I picked up on is, like, early in our relationship, like, there was a point where he was working as a green roofer, and that bought us time for me to take a chance on a new profession and to sort of shift tracks and mm-hmm. Take a risk. And then the risk paid off and I got a job I loved, which bought us permission for him to explore other options. And what I worry about is people not really having the opportunity to explore at all, that whether it's the male, the mom or dad, or even like a solo person, that it may trap people in whatever available profession they happen to be in, and that opportunity to take a chance won't exist because it's too scary to let yourself leave a job and start a new one. Like, even you doing that in October, I wonder if that same thing would have felt even remotely feasible in March. You know, if you'd stayed in your old job, would you have felt comfortable shifting in March?
Think about it all the time. That, like, should I have left my job? You know, you can't predict a world-ending pandemic, but like, oh, how different would this summer have gone had I not made that big career change?
Do you have any guesses as, like, based on previous summers of what, like, the remote version would have looked like? Would it have
I could have fully done that job remote. It would have been fine. It would have been very quiet. So I don't think I would have started artisanally, but I would have just continued, like, making it. Well, see, I started Candles as I was leaving my last job. So I also think about that too. It was like, would I have had that urge to do something creative and get to have this fun thing had I not been unhappy in what I was doing and looking to make a change?
Yeah.
Would I have even started doing this? So I my life could have been so totally different.
Yeah. Well, I think you probably would have been, like, when I think back on my creative ventures and what they were born out of, they were usually, something, if I got worried about whether or not a job was going to continue or was going to get precarious, that was usually when I leaned into a different skill set. So I'd have sort of a backup or a cushion, you know, if this one fails, I've got this one on the go. And so there's something to be said for kind of the creativity that emerges out of a time of unknowns and uncertainty. Yeah. I also don't know the proper way to balance that it can be inspiring to figure out a new reality when your world gets turned upside down, but it doesn't seem fair to turn people's worlds upside down to invoke creativity. Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, just make everyone a starving artist and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, I have been, yeah, I guess I did ask, there's a couple questions I've been asking people, and one is around support, and I sort of been asking that a bunch in a bunch of different ways, and I guess, like, if you are picturing the next few months, like, say Guelph stays on track for, or our area, I guess it's important to not just Guelph, but our region, say our region stays on track for fewer cases, and say there isn't a terrifying resurgence of this illness when schools open up.
I was just going to say, I'm giving it a month. I'm just hopeful for, like, as long of a break as I can get from being a stay-at-home mom.
Okay, well then, okay, maybe I'll, no, you're absolutely right. I'll reframe it. Whether, okay, so maybe there's two different possible outcomes. In an ideal world, if we're on the mend and there is a possibility that enough time can go by that we can, you know, find a vaccination or whatever it would mean to kind of go back. If, say, we have regular access to downtown businesses again, to different platforms for sharing, like, what would the ideal successful version of your new enterprise look like? So when we get out of crisis mode and into, like, maybe I'm going to try to make this a thing in the normal world too, what would be your ideal way of running this?
This continuing?
Yeah.
I mean, this all kind of came out, I think it started before COVID, because in the back of my mind, I had this idea where there was a store in downtown Guelph called The Handmade Den, and they closed down, and it was a store that sold, like, handmade goods and local artisans and things like that. And so it was kind of like, there's a gap in this now, and that's something that would be kind of, like, cool. So that was just sort of sitting in the back of my mind. So not that I want to open a storefront, but bringing an in-person aspect would be awesome. It's definitely on my mind of, like, doing maker nights or, like, networking things. Like, I just, like I said, I love events and I love talking to people. So if I can somehow bridge this into, like, having people come out and meet the person who makes their macrame, whatever, and learn how to do something, that's really cool. Like, that's a fun little night that you could do. Or, you know, on the business side of things, if you can have these small businesses get to come together and meet each other and learn from somebody who is doing something that they want to do, like, that kind of thing. I love that so much, where it's like, oh, you need help with, like, branding? Well, I know this really cool person, and, like, come and meet them and talk to them, and, like, maybe you can figure that out.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I dream about the day where I can have, like, an 8-hour work day to just focus on work and, you know, plan a couple months out and think about what the world will look like when we can, like, go to a pub again and just sit down and, like, network with people with similar mindsets to ourselves.
Yeah. Has the pandemic given you any new opportunities for seeing how people do what they do? So some of these very same people you were connected with before and knew a bit about what they make, have you had, because it really appeals to me, your description of seeing some of that process. I think about that all the time with, like, I do silk screening as one of the things I do. And yeah, the mystery of how it gets from that to that is just, is something most people haven't watched. And so sometimes the form isn't actually as out of reach for people to do as they think it is. It seems like a mystery, and it stays. And I mean, maybe for the artisan's sake, it's great to have things seem like impossible, like, for you to do yourself.
No, you could never make a candle. Please buy this one.
But yeah, it's really generous when people want to show the process, because, yeah, it does get, in theory, you know, make you more precarious to have some of your magic and mysteries unpacked. But, like, but I love it. And is there, like, yeah, I'm curious if you've had a chance to connect with any of your other fellow artists in that way to see some of their processes during this time.
The one thing that comes to mind is soap. I saw what actually goes into making soap and was like, oh, that's how you do it? Like, you make it in these big kind of tubs and layer it with the different parts of all of that. Like, oh, and it has to just sit and exist in its form for like 6 weeks. Like, soap was the, yeah, soap needs to cure for like a month and a half before you can actually use it. It's very bizarre.
Wow, but, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I learned about soap. That was probably a cool thing.
Yeah. Where does the inspiration come from? If like you saw this with soap, but if you haven't had a lot of opportunities to see behind the scenes, and then where does the inspiration come from to have that be part of the of your business model?
I mean, I just started looking for things that I really liked and then wanted to have for myself and assume that other people would like these things, I guess. Yeah. You know, where you... I tried to think of it as you would a market. So what are all the things that you can see at a market? And I really wanted to focus on like handmade small businesses. I didn't want to do like a food box or that kind of thing. Just because I had seen that there were already things popping up to support restaurants and other food producers. But so I had this niche in mind of like, small handmade businesses. What are all of the different kinds of handmade things I can think of, basically?
That makes sense to me. What are I guess for people listening who are curious about this box, what are some of the types of things? You've mentioned a few, like jewelry and candles. What are some of the other ones? Are there any that would maybe surprise people as to an unusual inclusion?
I am walking over to my office so I can look because I always forget. Oh, I have someone who makes like natural dishwasher products right now. That's pretty cool.
Oh, that is cool.
So like the dishwasher pods and that sort of thing. Really neat, like little rope bowls. It's hard to describe them in any other way, but it's like, do you know what I'm talking? Do you know?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're like when the pieces of fabric are tied into knot.
Oh, it's not knotted. It's like it's sewn. There, she's just put it in. I can show you. No one else will be able to see it, but like this, where it's
okay.
So it's like a spiral rope pattern, and then she's sewn it, and so it's just these cool little decor things. Yeah, I have a lot of like beeswax products, which are, I love them. People are really into like the food wraps, beeswax food wraps. And I'm working with a girl right now who does a lot of other like salves and lotions and things like that with her beeswax.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, my other question that I enjoy asking people is silver linings. So recognizing that, you know, the pandemic, even though it's been really hard and challenging on lots of levels, has been an opportunity for changes to take place and things to emerge that seem possible now that we maybe didn't consider before. And I'm curious, something you've seen emerge during this time that you would love to see continued, even if we got to go back. It's sort of similar to my question, I guess, around like your business returning, but in a broader sense of things you've seen, if there's been any silver linings that have emerged.
So not specific to me, just
doesn't have to be. I mean, it might be something that touches you, but not necessarily specific to your business, but maybe just something as a community or as a society that you've seen happen that that is a bright spot.
I think like kind of I touched on the initial surge of wanting to support local small businesses. Guelph is already such a great town for that. Like there's so many small independent stores and restaurants and that kind of thing. But just the surge to want to support that and to want to, you know, improve your community is great. And it's changing because of course it is right now, you know, everything always will go through that, but just to hopefully kind of continue to see that sort of community support, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm optimistic. I think
me too.
Yeah. It, with things like how much Pal's Trading Zone has thrived here and, just, you know, even like the tool library, like there's so many examples of, you know, kind of like umbrellas over the idea of us sharing resources or moving things around that we don't need anymore or don't need right now, but might need again later. It seems so much more sustainable to know who makes what when you need it rather than just buy everything you might ever need.
Yeah. And just, you can just throw it out. 'Cause if you need it, you can buy it again. It's no big deal. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a good example of something that we hopefully will stop doing as much.
Yeah, so it's just making me think of my husband who needs a lot of pants mended, and I was just like, my long forgotten skill of mending clothes, because you just, oh, just whatever, we'll get you new jeans, just throw them out, you know. Mm-hmm. And now I'm trying to rethink that in a, like, okay, you can fix a hole, it'll be fine, like, you can still use these pants.
Yeah, yeah, that's an interesting example, because he still goes out in the world, and so there is maybe still, like, a lingering expectation of how people present when they're in person, but I definitely think that the switch to us working out of our homes has totally flipped the concept of dressing for work on its head. Some of us are getting wilder and more zany than ever, and some have, like, gone full tilt pajama at all time. And
just, I love me some stretchy pants.
It's one that I always had a lot of anxiety around. I love getting dressed, but trying to think of all the different things my day might need me to do in one outfit has always been a little overwhelming. And working next to my wardrobe where I could make 5 outfit changes a day if I desire has made everything seem possible. It's so much more fun for me. And dressing for my upper half most of the time.
Yes.
Which is also... Yeah.
Your legs can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
You don't have to. Yep. No one needs to know.
That's my silver lining. Legs returning to the world as they are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe dropping some grooming habits that you had kept up strictly for the office.
Yeah. Or in my case, having more bubble baths than ever before.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, luxurious.
It's nice. It's nice to be able to shift modes. I think that's a big one for me. Like, I think you'd be amazed at how much more people can work if you let them have access to the other things they need in their day to sustain themselves. So if meal times and even nap times or bath times or whatever were as flexible as, like, the actual call to those things should be, then you actually can work a much longer work day, and it doesn't have to be, like, shoved into a box that's regimented in it. Those seem like such arbitrary restrictions now.
Yeah. I also think this has really highlighted how important our childcare workers are. And maybe we could pay them a little bit more money.
Yeah.
Not me, personally, because, oh my God, is daycare expensive? But, like, the government.
Yeah, yeah.
This is something that halts our society when we do not have childcare or schools or any of that kind of thing. Maybe we should treat these really important workers like they are really important at making the world function.
Well, it's another one that, as you're saying, it really parallels the earlier description of, like, how important it was for you. You wanted to have something as luxurious and nice as scented candles, and then, you know, had a shift in your body and couldn't consume them as they were and had to find a new one. But, like, the consideration of what your spaces look like for you to actually kind of thrive and be successful. And we should be thinking about that for our children, too. If our children leave our house to go somewhere, whether it's school or a childcare center, we should be thinking about, like, what do those spaces need and what do the people in them need to have this be a space where everyone thrives instead of just, like, tolerating the circumstances, you know. It's something I don't think we put a lot of thought in. We send them out the door and we don't think about it as much, but it's just as integral for them to have the ideal environment to grow in as it is for us.
Yeah, we could go on so many tangents. It sounds
Well, I mean, we're almost at an hour, so I would love to give you the opportunity to share links to your Copper Bell candle business, to your Artisanly.
It's made-up word. You can say it however you want.
Can you share some links for listeners who are curious about one or both of these ventures and want to connect with you? And
Websites are probably easiest, I think, right? So thecopperbell.ca, all the words spelled how you would expect them to be spelled. and then Artisanly is A-R-T-I-S-A-N-L-Y, artisanly.ca.
Awesome. So. And you can share social media links too. I know a lot of people love the Instagram is a popular choice for.
Love me some Instagram. I'm going to get, so the Copper Bell is at the.copper.bell on Instagram and Facebook. And Artisan Lee is at artisanlee.ca on Facebook and Instagram as well.
Thank you so much for making the time available today. I'm glad we found a window of nap time where you could talk about your ventures, and I really super appreciate it.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thank you.
So once again, that was Katrina Bell of The Copper Bell and Artisanally. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform